It is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Tony N. from Fresno. And when he gets a little crunchy inside, he says that he stops and prays and gets into service. It's Tony.
Good evening. My name's Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, and I was just thinking a little bit ago when the people came up to the stage, how awkward it must feel. For some people, it's a little bit more comfortable. For others, it is a little less comfortable. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of me. One of the things that I learned when I started to first drink was all of a sudden some of that, those jitters, the uncomfortableness kind of vanished. I kind of call it liquid courage. When I started drinking when I was probably in a long time ago, actually. And some of you probably weren't even born then, but anybody born after 1968? Okay, well then some of you may know that. But in any case, I was introduced to actually really drinking when I was in college. We had this little get-together on Fridays. It was called TGID, which stood for Thank God I'm Drunk. Another form of calling it was also keggers, because there was this one place where everybody just kind of got together at, and we just drank as much beer as we could. I remember when I first had my first drunk, I can remember very, very well. Not so much my last drunk, but you know what? I never want to forget my first drunk. You may hear sometimes people say, never forget your last drunk. Well, I don't know. For me, my journey through drinking was actually kind of boring. I mean, I drank a lot. As soon as I got that sensation of I could take on Godzilla, Genghis Khan, the Muppets, and everybody else all together, I could. I thought I could kind of rule the world. The interesting part of that also was that when I was in college, I started up this group of people that we got together on Friday afternoons, see, because I wanted to be a little bit more classy rather than drink just beer, and I started this little wine tasting club, and we'd go and get some nice wine, we'd get some nice cheese, and we'd start drinking. It seemed funny that after about 4 or 5 months, I was no longer being told in what room or what dorm and what room the club was meeting. And later on, I found out that it was because I usually waited around and I drank all the wine. Actually, I drank more than everybody else. And that really wasn't so much a big deal to me. I just kind of brushed it off. I don't know about some of you, but one of the things that I realized even before I started drinking was I didn't like to be told what to do. And I'm also a recovering Catholic, so I don't mean to offend anybody there that you know, that is still practicing. And you know, if you are, good for you, because one of the things that I've found through the program is I've found a different spiritual contact with my higher power. I actually go to 2 churches nowadays, but the fact was that when I was in school, one of the things that we were told was, this is how you're going to memorize everything, especially in the religious classrooms. And then I also was taught that God was this person who was a supreme being, if you want, who was very, very unforgiving, and, you know, fire and brimstone, especially if I looked at somebody the wrong way, or if I lied, or if I did some of these things that were being told to us. The interesting portion to this also is that I carried that on, but not being, not liking what to be told to do, through a lot of years of my drinking and schooling and working. See, because even when I worked, I didn't like to be told what to do. Because, see, I still knew it all. It also got me into trouble. But the fact was that my drinking. You know, I really wanted to kind of talk more about the rewards of this program rather than all of my drunk log, because, you know, some of you may have done some very embarrassing things. I certainly had my fool. A couple quick stories, and then I'll get into kind of what happened with me. There was a time when I used to drink a lot with a family member, and we would go to restaurants. And I still remember this one restaurant down in Southern California. And he and I got so drunk that when people said, "We're going to go," he and I literally crawled underneath the table with the cloth. You know, the tablecloth came down so nobody would see us, so we could continue to drink. Kind of a little bit of the, anybody ever watch any of these Cheech and Chong movies? It was kind of like the same thing. But didn't make much, I didn't care. That's what I did when I got drunk. There was a time also when, and this was now when I was living in Mexico City, that on one New Year's Eve, when the clock struck 12 and it was brand new year, I was outside with a couple of family members, and we were drunk, and we got a gun, and we started firing, trying to blow out a street light. And right next to that street light, in terms of distance, was an apartment building. And, see, I didn't care. I just never thought about it. I thought it was the thing to do. It was fun. I had no sense. That's a good term right there. I actually had no sense of what was right and what was wrong. Nor did I even consider the fact that I might have hurt somebody, let alone kill someone. I also remember one other a story that I'll be as politically correct as I can, because there are some children here. But there was one time that my wife, when I woke up, said to me, "Do you remember who you spoke to last night?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, your mom called." And I said, "Oh, do you remember what you told your mom?" I said, "Nope." And she said, "Well, you know, you told her to basically do something to you that sometimes guys like having people do to them." You know, to this day, my mother and I have never spoke of that. And at some point in time, you know, I guess I'm willing to make amends, but I'm going to have to figure this one out. I think maybe I'll have to call my sponsor and try to figure out how to best direct that, or just where it says when to do so would injure them or others. Those are just some of the little stories, you know, that that I did when I was drinking. At that point in time, as I said, I really didn't have much sense of right or wrong, especially after I drank. I kind of had an idea that some of the things that I was doing was not proper or appropriate, maybe because of my religious upbringing. My mother's very, very religious, and good for her. And the fact still remains that the moment that I took a drink, it was all, you know, everything was the sky. It didn't make any difference. It really didn't. I'm sorry to say that to this date, I don't know whether I actually injured someone when I was firing that revolver. I don't know that I actually want to know, but and there's some selfish reasons. I don't think I want to be in jail in a Mexican town anywhere, even if it's around the border. I don't care. I don't want to be there. Because part of my story also is that I have either been in jail or I've been incarcerated sort of in three different countries because of my alcoholism. Mexico was the first country to put me in jail for a short period of time, but I didn't quite like it. And the reason for that was because maybe some of you folks are aware of people who are illegal in this country. You know, they come across, they don't have papers, or they come across from wherever. It doesn't have to be just from, you know, the southern border. I was one of those, except in reverse. When I graduated from school, I thought I was a big hot shot, had a good education. I thought I spoke both English and Spanish pretty well until I got down there, and then I realized that it probably wasn't as strong as I thought it was. And when I couldn't find a job, I basically went underground. And what that underground meant was that I had an aunt who helped me find some false documents. And so I paid a little bit of money, had the false birth certificate, then I was able to get a false military card, and then I was able to get a false Social Security card. And then I was working. That story ends pretty quickly, 4 or 5 years after that, when my wife was no longer, my first wife now, was no longer really very tolerating of my drinking and my my gallivanting around the city with people that I shouldn't have been gallivanting with. In other words, I did not keep many of my marriage vows. So when I was in my office and I had some people from what today would be considered the Homeland Security nowadays, I had a couple of agents pop into my office and say, "You need to come with us." From there, they gave me less than a week to pay a fine and to get out of the country. And I thought, ooh, here's where it starts to get interesting for me. During that entire time period, I always blamed my wife. I blamed my then mother-in-law. I blamed my then sister-in-law. And I had a daughter. Well, my wife did, but she was born in 1976, and when I came back here, I was blaming everyone for the fact that they had taken my daughter from me. The story goes on. I get back here. I decide I'm going to do my own divorce thing. Get the divorce. Meet another young woman who we end up getting married a few years later. And The only thing that had changed in me was time. In other words, whatever I was doing back then, I was still doing with my new wife. We got pulled over once for I was driving down on what's called the Pasadena Freeway. I know they changed the name. It has a lot of curves in it. And we got pulled over because I was speeding. I was also drunk. My wife was, six months pregnant with our first child. And the only reason why they let me go was because they saw that she was with child and that she would drive the rest of the way home. Back then, they kind of left you off on those types of things. I don't know if they do it that nowadays or not. As time progresses in my life, in my clock, I realized that my education had gone from a decent education in college to a PhD. Now, it's not the PhD that you folks think of, but it's a PhD in rationalization. And it's a PhD. I've got two. I've got also a postdoc after that, and that's on justification. So, if any of you belong to that university, please let me know. We'll go out and have a great time and talk about all of our justifications and rationalizations throughout our life. Because even after that, of course, I had gotten to be very, very good at justifying and rationalizing just about anything. And I could sometimes justify my rationalization. And then the other way around, I could rationalize my justification. I got drunk on many occasions, but there was one time when I'm coming home from, it was the October 1976 World Series. I think it was Boston and Dodgers. And, of course, I was drinking. And I was going home. And as soon as I'm kind of pulling into the driveway of my home, there are lights going on. And I thought, oh, shit. So I opened up the garage, went in, thought, cool, maybe I'll just close the garage door. But police officer didn't say, no, I need to talk to you for a second. Went out, talked with them. My wife came out. When someone is totally disappointed in you, when they come out, look, shake their head, turn around and go back in. And that's what she did. The police officer was just about ready to let me go. And I thought, ah, God, I got away with it again. And the problem was that I had, I wasn't living at home at that time. I had my own apartment. So I had brought my clothes over so that in the morning I could change. And when the police officer said, can I have your license, please? I couldn't find it. It was where I had put it, but I didn't remember where I had put it. So I think seeing the fact that I could not find my license to verify that I actually lived there, we did the sobriety test, and then I ended up going to court, and I want to justify and rationalize everything there. And a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, and that was when the police officer had cuffed me and put me in the car, something in me said, you finally got caught. But it wasn't one of jubilance. It was one more of, it finally happened. That was, again, back in October of 1986. Found an attorney thought we were going to beat it because this buddy of mine who I worked with said, hey, I know the attorney that got this famous singer off. And I thought, okay, that's who I want. So a bunch of bucks later, and standing in front of the court and having the attorney say, listen, I heard the tape. We're just going to plead this out in nolle contendere, and you'll be on your way. And I thought, oh, okay, so I guess that's okay. I didn't quite learn my lesson because I was still drinking. However, one of the things that the court did was they said, you know, you're going to have to go to this program, and you've got to go to 6 meetings. Now, back when I got sober, a lot of the rooms were smoke-filled because they allowed smoking back then. And I thought, yeah, I don't want to do that. You know, why do I want to go to a room with a bunch of drunks that don't they know how to do smoke? And they smell like cigarette and eh. So I also take some classes. They gave me this little questionnaire. I don't know if any of you have taken that questionnaire. But, you know, it says if you've answered more than one of these, you're probably an alcoholic. And I still remember going back and trying to change a bunch of those check marks. You know, Dr. Nieto here with the justification and rationalization, PhD and postdocs. I was still not following what was going on. I do remember my first meeting. It was probably one of the greatest experiences that I ever had. It's down in Southern California, because I got sober down in, I don't know if anybody has ever heard of the 502 Club. We call it the sobriety capital of the world. It's in Covina, California. They have this big banner that says sobriety capital of the world, so that's why I'm repeating it. And I walked towards this place. It was a church, and there was this young lady who saw me, and she says, hi, my name's Jerry. And I thought, okay. So if your name's Jerry, good. She says, are you here for a meeting? And I said, yeah, I was sent by the court. She said, well, come on in. Just go in and, you know, get some coffee and what have you. And how some of the folks walked up here today, that's why I'm kind of going back to this, kind of going, I don't know if I really want to be here. Should I be here? I'm uncomfortable. That's exactly how I felt. I didn't know where to put my hands. I didn't have to put them in my pocket, keep them out. I do know that when everybody went around, and back then they would go around and introduce each other and then say, hi, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. By the time it got to me, I guess that's, you know, that's kind of the high sign. So I said, hey, I'm Tony, I'm an alcoholic. Did I believe it back then? Not sure. Because my justification and rationalization degrees were still very rampant. But I do know this. When I left that first meeting, it was like no other feeling that I had ever had. The simple reason was that when people started to talk and share about their experiences and their, you know, how much they got drunk and what they did, what they didn't do and all this crap, I thought, wow, how do you know that about me? Now, they were telling their story, but they were telling my story. And when they said, you know, I don't really know what to say, I'm kind of a newcomer, I knew, I empathized with them because that was, again, me. And it was very, very interesting because I kept coming back to that room and a number of other rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous, because every time I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I take something away from it today. I say today because there is a caveat to that. Dr. Rationalization and post-doc here. For many years, when I was at a meeting and if I didn't kind of like what the person was talking about, or the whole group, I immediately shut off. I was no longer here right now in this very moment, and now I was doing my other, well, another one of my character defects, not the only three that I have, but one of my other wonderful character defects, which was, I was looking at you and I was judging you. You know, I don't know if that applies to any of you out there, but I can tell you that's who I was. And I remember one day talking to my sponsor saying, you know, I don't really get anything out of that meeting. You know, all they do is whine and complain and that. And I said, geez, when is so-and-so going to stop doing this or that? And he looked at me and he said, when are you going to stop complaining and add something to the meeting? And sometimes that adding to the meeting today for me means listen to what the person is saying and look for the gift in the message. Because anytime someone shares in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings today, I truly look for that gift. It might sound kind of strange to some of you, but, you know, that gift is, what are you saying that reminds me of me that I don't like? Or what are you saying that I actually need to hear? And, you know, accept as something for me to, you know, look at and grow on. So, that's kind of what started me on the road in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is March 17th of 1987. And that's not as important as was anybody up earlier than 3 o'clock this morning? Yes? Yeah, 1, 2, 3. Okay, then you've got more time of sobriety than I have. Because all I have is today. And it took me a long time to realize that what happened to me yesterday is gone. And if I start thinking about everything that may happen in the not so much tomorrow, but in a week's time or a month's time or what have you, then I'm losing everything that I could potentially do today for a fellow alcoholic, or maybe I forget to be of service to someone else. Because being of service for me doesn't always mean that I have to be of service to someone in Alcoholics Anonymous. It certainly helps more, because when someone starts to tell me what's going on with them, it's amazing how much of what they're saying to me I need to hear at that very moment. And I get to share it with them as well. So that's one of the blessings that I've received from this program. When I also got here, it took me about 2.5 years. Do not suggest that any of you do this unless you'd like pain. And that's it. It took me 2.5 years to do my fourth step. And that was my first fourth step. And the very simple reason why it took me so long was because Dr. Rationalization and Justification here didn't want to look at my part. I did not want to look at who I was. And it gets even more interesting from there. Because I did my fourth step. Did my first, well, going on 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And there was still something missing in everything that I was doing. You see, because even though I had worked the program and had done those first 12 steps, it took me 2.5 years. It took me about 16 and a half years more to finally start to discard this PhD in justification and rationalization. Because some of the behaviors that I had prior to my drinking and while I was drinking were still there. My wife has come with me on a number of these service calls that I have, as I call them, but to be of service to you folks. And so she's heard everything that I'm about to tell you, and that was I was still not fulfilling my marriage vows through 19 years of being sober. And now I'm not proud of that, and I don't say that as a wow, you know, look at me here. Fact is, I got caught. Sometimes it takes a lot of pain, as I said earlier. But more importantly, what it did for me was it took me into another dimension for myself, and that was the ability to finally start looking at myself and starting to get honest with me. See, because that has been one of the hardest challenges for me. How honest can I get first with myself? And it took me a long time. And the other thing that I learned was I learned to trust my brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, because if you go out today and say, man, you know that guy he's talking about? He was still cheating on his wife and he was 19 years sober and what have you. Today, I'm no longer embarrassed with that. And the reason for it is because I'm working on this program. It doesn't make any difference to me today. Now, did I hurt my wife? Hell yeah. Did I hurt my children? Hell yeah. Now, did I hurt my first wife? Absolutely. And did I hurt that other family? Absolutely. And it wasn't until last year, I'm going to say it was last year, well, I know it was last year, October, but one of the things when we start working our program, honestly, and we start looking at 10 steps, one of the things that I knew was that I needed to do a 10th step, or at least make an attempt to do a 10th step with my first wife. They still live in Mexico. In October of last year, I was a speaker at the Sierra Club in Fresno. And I was sharing with them part of the story that I got run out of the country. I hadn't seen my daughter. You know, look what they had done to me. And one of the things that I realized was, you know what? She never abandoned me. I'm the one who abandoned her. Because I could have always gone back, and I never did. In October 10th, to be exact, I send a friend request to my former wife, not knowing what the result was going to be. It was a 50-50 chance. And I got at the end of the hour, I checked my emails or my text messages, and that first wife had accepted my friend request. And I thought, whoa. Then, the very next day, October 11th of 2015, my daughter, who I've not seen in 36 and a half years, sent me a friend request. And I get to tell you that this coming Saturday is going to be one of the most eventful moments for me because I'm getting on a plane and I'm actually going to see my daughter. That is a result of this program. It's nothing else. Had I kept with the rationalization and justification, doctorate, postdoctorate stuff, I wouldn't be up here telling you, you know, part of this story. Because it didn't happen in my time, and I don't know what my time would have been. It happened in God's time. And I don't know if some of you have heard in the past, someone said this to me, so I'm just passing it forward. And that's, if you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans. Tell him your plans. And it's kind of an interesting piece. Now, I got arrested in Mexico and then got asked to leave. I got arrested here, and you're saying, well, you know, you said three times. Here's the funny story of this. I was already sober. I was working for a company that had sent me to Canada. And I'm walking into customs and immigration, and I don't know. I mean, they must have looked at my face and said, he's guilty. And the person at the immigration office said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm here to put on some training for managers of this particular company. And I don't know. I guess he didn't like the answer. And the customs people came over, and they said, you know, can you come with us? And I went, oh, I'm sober. I haven't done anything. What's going on? So they interview me, and they ask me, have you ever been arrested? I said, yeah. And they said, what for? And I said, well, in the States. I didn't tell them about Mexico. I said, in the States, I got arrested for drunk driving. Now, I don't know if there's anybody here from Canada, but if you're not here and you've never been to Canada, or if you've had a driving arrest here, if you ever go to Canada and for some particular reason you don't go past the border, guards and that kind of stuff, the immigration and what have you, they will very kindly say, back then it was a misdemeanor for me. So what they would say today is your misdemeanor there, meaning in this country, the United States of America, is actually a felony in Canada. Now, I was never tried in Canada, and they never said, you know, you're a felon, but I'm a felon in Canada. So I got put aside for a while. They checked out my story, came back, yeah, I was telling the truth. And the officer said, you know, I should not let you come into the country. But I can see that what you're saying to me has been the truth, and that you're only going to be here for, I think it was a week. And he says, we expect you to be on a plane after that. And I went, okay, thank you so much. Then they gave me this get well letter from the government of Canada that said, if you ever want to come back to Canada, you will need to ask for permission from the Canadian government. Go to the embassy and, you know, do all that stuff. So to this day, I've never been back to Canada. I have no reason to be back in Canada. Beautiful country, great people. And my rationalization and justification for years was those, look what they did to me. Yeah. And you know what they did? They did their job. That's all they did. They were doing their job. So that's another little piece of my story. And that, after being sober, and of course the worst one, and I'm not sure if it was the worst one, it was the gift that I needed to receive at the time that I got from God. And that was after 19 years being caught, because it actually got me started on another path. And today, you know, I can tell you everything I did this morning. I can tell you everything that happened this afternoon. You know, it's been a great time being here with all of you. And the other thing that I've also learned is, and I say this on many of my closings, which is, be kind to yourself. Do no harm. Work the steps. Call your sponsor. Be of service. Trust in your higher power. And have a nice day unless you have other plans. All of that I learned here over the years. So it's about time for me to wrap this up. I want to thank you for letting me be of service, and have a good night, unless you have other plans. So thanks for letting me share.